Hello, everyone, and welcome to Washington Hall and Black in Seattle, continuing the discussion. I am Tanya Mosley, and thank you. I was super nervous about tonight. I mean, I was really nervous, and I'm nervous again because I'm just so happy to see so many people turn out for tonight's event, and I see the community so varied, and I see so many Black people. I want to ask, where are you guys? I don't think I've seen, I mean, I know a couple of you, but there's so many beautiful faces here that I've never seen before. Well, as you know, this was sparked from my Black in Seattle series, the four-part series on KUOW. And very briefly, there were four parts. The first part was the overarching Black in Seattle. The second part was the Seattle Public Schools busing experiment. The third part was being a Black man in Seattle and navigating as such. And the fourth part was being a single Black woman in Seattle. I really just touched the surface. I mean, it was from my point of view, and I knew going into it that I was just scratching the surface. So I really thank KUOW for giving us this opportunity to gather together and take the discussion further. Now, I also want you all to know the significance of Washington Hall. There was a specific reason why we chose this historic location. And I have someone who, she's looking pretty nervous herself over here, to talk to you all very briefly about why we chose this location. Come on up.
Those are my friends clapping really hard. So my name is Lulu Carpenter. I work here with Van Deep. If Van Deep can wave her hand. Oh, she's probably working and putting out chairs somewhere. So if you see her around, oh, she's actually up there in the balcony taking pictures. Wave to her. She's the rental manager, so if you ever want to rent Washington Hall, that's the person that you go to. And I'm here as the operations manager. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about Washington Hall, which is here in the Central District. And as you all know, the Central District used to be a red line district. And so the significance of what Washington Hall is and what the steering committee is trying to create as 206 Zulu, Hoodmo, as well as Voices Rising, we have a lot of fans in the audience, is that this is a historic site that we're trying to continue that legacy. And we're doing that as much as possible. Please give us your feedback, as well as knowing that there's a lot of greats and a lot of musical greats here, which was hip-hop, as well as jazz, as well as Jimi Hendrix was on this very stage, as well as Billie Holiday and a lot of other great people. People that have owned this building before, besides Historic Seattle, owns the... And Kai Kelly, the director of real estate, I see you. He did not want to be pointed out, is actually in the audience. Can you give him a hand? He's doing a lot of hard work for Historic Seattle. Historic Seattle purchased the building a few years ago with the support of 4Culture. And with 4Culture, supported the anchor groups as well as the anchor partners coming on into Washington Hall so it could be a collaboration between development as well as community and grassroots groups. And so we're doing that work every single day. We love this hall very, very greatly. And if you can just feel the energy in the hall that people have come here to celebrate weddings as well as funerals, and that legacy is carrying on today. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Lulu. So we're going to get right into it because I want us to have a really great conversation with our panelists, and I also want you all to be able to ask questions and also delve into some of the topics that you wrote down when you first came in here. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my panel, or our panel, rather. So first off, I'd like to introduce Trish Molinas-DeZocco. And she is the founder of Technology Access Foundation. It's a nonprofit school for science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM. Now, TAF was founded in 1996, and she founded it after working for 15 years as a developer, designer, and manager in the high-tech industry. Next, we have Felicia Loud. And Felicia is part of the socially conscious R&B and hip-hop group Black Stacks, based out of Seattle. Felicia is an integral part of Seattle's Black community, starring in several critically acclaimed shows. Next, we have Sean Scott. Sean Scott is a director and writer. He moved here from New York at age 10. His first film was Seat of Empire, a three-hour documentary tour of Seattle's past. In 2012, he released 100% Off, a recession-era romance, a feature-length docudrama, and his latest narrative, Pacific Aggression, will be released next year. Yeah. We have Sandra Jackson Dumont, the Deputy Director of Education and Public Programs at the Seattle Art Museum, an adjunct curator. Sandra moved to Seattle from Harlem. She's credited with creating great moments in the city. And last but not least, we have Sharon Williams, the Managing Director of the CD Forum. It's King County's only full season of cultural events exclusively dedicated to presenting Black culture through the performing arts and humanities. And I know you all are looking at this panel, as great as they are, you see Sean in the middle, surrounded by all these beautiful ladies here. We have a couple of people in the front row that I'm also going to be referring to, including Anthony Shoecraft, if you can stand up, Anthony. He is the Community Engagement Manager for the Community Center of Education Results, an organization that is building career education initiative, the Roadmap Project, in Southeast Seattle and South King County. And then, where's Jace from? Okay. If you can stand up, he's with Black Stacks as well. Now, when you all first arrived, you were greeted by this map here. And you all were also asked to write about the topics that you'd like to talk about tonight. And based on what you put here, we had a chance to take a look based on the color of the dot, what race you are, and then the part of town you live in. And I'm also going to ask you a show of hands, first off, who lives in South Seattle? If you can raise your hand. Central Seattle. Wow, a lot of Central people. North Seattle. Wow, a lot of North Seattle people, too. Northern suburbs, so Edmonds, those types of areas. Not that one person. What about the south suburbs? So Renton, Tukwila, those types of places. And then we've got some islanders and some people really far out. So, like the islands, Vashon, Bremerton. Well, I think based on what you see, there still is a lot of segregation in Seattle. The Central District is mixed with a lot of people. The Rainier Valley is credited with being the most diverse zip code in the city. But when you talk about the north and further north, it's still pretty white. And I think we wanted to start off this forum today talking about that. Sean Scott and I had a chance to have a brief discussion about that. He has really done a lot of historical look at that. And I'd like to talk to you about maybe why you think we still see that today.
Well, I think to understand, you have to go back not just to maybe the beginning of where anybody's his own individual stay in Seattle began, but also back to the history of the city as a whole, as you were saying, Tanya, and that one thing that you have to know about sort of the foundation or the very origins of how Seattle was sort of built from the ground up, if you would. Many of the neighborhoods that we think of as quintessentially Seattle, right? So it could be Ballard, Beacon Hill, could be Pioneer Square. Many of these neighborhoods didn't begin to fill in as we know them today until the 1890s or so, with the gold rush, right? At that time, a lot of the city was zoned to be composed mostly of primarily single-family housing. And that's where you get, like it or not, and for better or worse, it's where you get most of the character of Seattle today. It comes from the fact that we have large neighborhoods with nothing but swabs of single-family homes with small pockets of maybe commercial real estate or entertainment or industrial real estate, right? Going off of that, what was realized very early on with the population that was filling in Seattle is that in order to protect the investment that primarily folks of European descent, as they started to fill the city in, they came to the very, I want to say, decisive conclusion that in order to protect the property investment of owning a home, what needed to happen was the establishment of what are called racially restrictive housing covenants. And so I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a neighborhood in Seattle that didn't have one of these racially restrictive housing covenants on the books. If you go back and look at, if you go back and look at some of the language that these racially restrictive housing covenants had, a lot of them came out point blank and compared having cattle or having hogs or having and having African-American neighbors, right? Those were equally offensive, right? These were all things that could be done to take away value from the property investment that people were making. And many of these didn't come off the books, you have to understand, until very early in the 2000s. I think the last one in Ennis Arden came off in 2005. So it's not a mistake that when you see a map such as this, if somebody can tell you their zip code, you're able to assume a lot more about what their upbringing was like, what their class status was like, and a lot of times what their nationalization status was like, based on the fact that we had pockets of neighborhoods and pockets of communities that, however vibrant they were and however much they contributed to the well-being and still contribute to the well-being of the city, weren't able to crop up or develop anywhere else. So I think that's a lot of the root behind some of the issues that we'll probably get into more.
Yeah, and that really brings up the issue of gentrification. Mm-hmm. Someone wrote here, what's happening? Gentrification of Seattle. Where is everyone going? Mm-hmm. The Central District was historically known as the place where black people lived. And today, it's becoming less and less so. Could anyone on the panel talk to that or would like to comment on that?
I'll just say that I'm not from here, but I moved here in 85, and I lived in the CD for most of that until 4.5 years ago. And what I saw in that time was families had elders in their home, and then when they went to either they passed away or they went to a care facility, the children had already moved away. And they didn't want to move back in the home. And so that was around the time where the real estate prices were very high. And so they sold them to people who wanted to buy the homes, and the people who had the money were usually Caucasians. And so I watched my 3 or 4 blocks completely change in a 10-year period. Where I moved in, it was very, very diverse. And I would say, you know, within a couple of years, it just, you know, kept changing and changing. And I wish that you can't make people stay in their community. We created a society where you go where the best jobs are. We don't grow up and raise our own kids in our community anymore because there are jobs all over. We're an international society. So unless you can keep the family within the home within your family, it's going to get turned over. And the economy is such here that people are moving out, moving south, and the people who are living in the city are the people who can afford it. Mm-hmm. So the high-tech industry contributed to some of that as well.
In doing research for the series, I found that, so it's something called the Second Great Migration, and that is from the late 70s on, the Second Great Migration, blacks moving to the secondary suburbs. So Renton, Tukwila, further out. But you know, Seattle is the only major city in the United States that does not have a black center. And so you can really look at that as a positive, or you can look at it as a negative. But really, I want to know how you feel about it. So I'm looking at Danielle from Good Hair Salon, but I know she also lives in the CD, and so I'm going to put you in the spotlight and just ask you how you feel about that, and if you can come up.
Hi, everybody. How do I feel about there not being a black center in Seattle? Personally, what I did when I moved back to Seattle, so I moved to Seattle originally when I was about 14. I got to go to Garfield, which was great, but my stepfather fought for that because I came when they were busing, which was part of your series. And he went down to the school district and told them that they had to let me in, that he wasn't sending me to Nathan Hale, and that he made them put me in a class. I think it was marine biology, and that was the only class that kind of qualified me to have to go to Garfield. And mind you, I lived on 30th and Cherry, so I was just a few blocks away from the school, so there was no reason for me to go all the way to Nathan Hale. What I've noticed is that the central area was pretty much the black center, and it's changed over the years with the gentrification. For me, I created my own black center when I moved back. I moved to Oakland for 10 years. and live there wonderfully, and you know how diverse Oakland is. And when I moved back to Seattle and wanted to only do natural hair, and people kept telling me, oh, that ain't gonna work. You're not gonna do relaxers, you're not gonna straighten, how are you gonna survive in Seattle? And that was in the early 90s. I mean, and I did, and things thrived, because what it was is that the community wanted it, but nobody had created it. So you create your own Black Center. Mm-hmm. That's what happened for me. I created a business that thrives off the Black community. Thank you very much for supporting it. Thank you very much for supporting it.
Excellent. I wanted to get some perspective. And I also, once we are done with the panel, I'm also going to have a Q&A. And I want to get as many questions, comments from you out there, because I really want to hear your voice. You know, that delves into some other things that you all have here, some really great questions. What can we do to retain Blacks, to keep Blacks here in Seattle? That's a question that someone wrote. And I have some people here on the arts, on the panel on the arts, in the arts world. I'd like to ask you, Sharon, first off, what do you think, from a person who's an artist, what can we do to retain Blacks?
I think what we can do to retain is support, continue to support. I think we do a really good job at it now, but we could do better. I think as far as Black actors and actresses are concerned, we can't rely on other communities to produce our work for us, to give them jobs, to keep them here. It is a sad situation when you hear a Black actor say they're going to move to Chicago or they're moving to New York because they can't find work here in Seattle. I just had a friend that is moving to New Jersey at the beginning of the year to be closer to New York. So I think supporting and coming out to the local independent plays and the local independent shows, and although national artists are great and we love them to come into town, we also like to see everyone at Langston Hughes Performing Arts Center, at shows that come here at Washington Hall, shows that are performed at Rainier Valley, down at Spectrum. Donald Byrd is down there. That's how we keep them here, is by supporting them and encouraging them to continue to work. And one of the things that I've done personally, because as an artist and as an arts administrator, was I realized that I have to create if I want to keep to work in Seattle. So it's very important, if you have that drive in you, not to sit around and wait for somebody to create that for you, but you begin to create it yourself. And Seattle is the best place that would allow you to create, and some people will come out and see it. Don't think you're going to get 300 your first show. You may get 50, but 50 is a good-sized audience. But you'll hear national artists say that Seattle is the best place to create. You go to New York to work. You go to Chicago to work. But if you want to have your own voice, you come to Seattle, and you share your voice here. And that's how you keep us here.
I'm so perplexed, though. Thank you. That was a really good answer. I'm really, really, I'm going to get to all the panelists, but I got to go back to Sean, because Sean brought up something to me earlier, that these issues that we're dealing with now, we've been dealing with them since the beginning of the Black of time in Seattle here. He brought up a book, The Black Victorians, and some of the same issues that I brought up in the series, mm-hmm. brought up in that book, and that book was written a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I'm very perplexed as to, what is it? What is that one element that really keeps our population steady or declining? And I know that's loaded, but I'm just asking.
Oh, you wanted me to answer
that?
Yeah. Okay. In the overarch, I'd have to say that one of the things that I, as a Black artist who calls Seattle home, one of the things that I find the most disquieting is sort of this dynamic where it seems like these are things that I've internalized and read, not lived through directly, obviously, but it seems as if every, I don't know, 20 to 25 years or so, we go through a little bit of a generational reset, right? So there will be an initial community that comes out here. It could have been the Black Victorians in the very beginning, right? You push forward, forge very forward, but then the reserves of energy that it takes to do that, I think, is very taxing. So maybe people from the second generation then kind of make the decision that they're going to go to explore other things. Well, then once the population leaves, a lot of the institutions or the businesses that were established by them in the first place, it's difficult to retain those as well. And nor does that stop people from wanting to come here in the second place. So it seems like it's a little bit of a cycle, and that the most viable thing that could be done by the Black community here to attract either more people or to establish more institutions that are lasting is just the ones that are here find and make more reasons to stay, as you had said earlier. I think it's not too much harder or simpler than that.
Sandra, you're shaking your head.
No. I am, because Esther Mumford wrote that book, Black Victorians, and she actually lives in Les Chi. I think her daughter Zora is here, Zola Mumford is here, waving her hand, who actually curates and is deeply involved in the film festival, the Black Film Festival at Langston Hughes. And I'm shaking my head because I just think I don't know why Black people have to stay in Seattle.
Okay.
I'm asking myself, I'm not from Seattle, I'm from the Fillmore in San Francisco, went to New York, stayed there for 16 years, came back, but I want Black people to go wherever they want to go. And I want them, and I think that Seattle could be appealing as an anchor place, and a place, but I think that it also could be this amazing place that people want to call home, and I think you're talking about desire. Like, the fact that people should desire to stay here and not feel like they have to have some kind of psychic pull from somewhere else. Does that make sense? That I want to be drawn to New York, that I want to be drawn to this other place. And I think that there's some vibrancy that exists here that I don't necessarily believe is totally unique to Seattle. Overton Berry said, who's an incredible jazz musician, said recently that black musicians, when they stop through Seattle, that they stopped through here, and they said, this is where I came to Seattle so that I could actually become a better part of myself, and I went to New York to be famous. And so speaking to what Sharon is saying, like, there's something nature, black people like, or people, I shouldn't just say black people, I think there's something beautiful about Seattle. It's green all the time. It's luscious, it's seductive. And there's a myth that people of color don't necessarily connect to the land. And I think that that is not true, and Seattle proves that myth wrong. And then the last thing I'll say is that my husband and I moved from New York. My husband is Haitian, and when we came to Seattle, we both became Black Americans, but we'll get into that later. But but we moved to Pioneer Square, and we were in search of, like, wherever we could be, and everyone kept telling us Capitol Hill or Columbia City. Those were the diverse places, and then we moved. We found a place that we loved the structure of the house, and it happened to be in the central area. And then we did research on the neighborhood, and we're like, yeah, that's definitely where we live. Because coming from a place as diverse as New York and moving to a place as diverse in a different way, Seattle, it made sense for us to kind of perpetuate blackness in that neighborhood. And actually, there's a poet that walked past our window and saw us sitting in our window and said, y'all in there? And we said, yeah. And he said, It's Gabriel, who's right in the back here, a really super poet. And he says, you know, wow, I'm glad somebody keeping it black in the CD. We didn't know what that meant. We did not know what that meant. And I think that's fascinating based on what you were saying. And so I guess I'm interested in Seattle having a cosmic pull for people, that it has the resilience and kind of magnetic something that other places have, and it does if you get to know it. But we don't talk about it enough. So I don't know that black people need to stay in Seattle. I also don't think that it's a big enough town for some of the great talent that's here to stay here. You know, I mean, it's small geographically. Anyway, I need to come here.
Well, I want to, touching on that, I want to, I know, right? Felicia, you could have gone anywhere. You could be anywhere right now, but you've chosen Seattle as a place to stay. So talk to me about the cosmic pool for you.
So I could have chose any place. Work is...
We got to bring it closer to you.
For the work that I do, so I'm a singer, been here over 40 years. And when talking about, you know, staying here or being here. There's a richness here that people like to get here. They take it, they feed on it, and then they leave. And they take it with them, and they don't give it back. That's the biggest thing for me. And so, yes, there is this thing about being here and staying here and having people come to you because they know that there is a pull already here. And so, you know, I grew up in theater with Bobby Wooten, Steve Sneed, Rico Bembry, you know, at Langston Hughes Performing Arts Center, and Sherry Cerezze. And when I went to Langston Hughes, I saw business being ran, what we were talking about earlier as far as business being ran by black people. Now, I had lived in Seattle for a very long time, and what I had not seen was that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. That made me want to stay because I saw in other people what it is that I wanted to do. I had black writers around me, directors, filmmakers. I had all that, and that was rich. And so the reason for not leaving was because I didn't feel like nobody leaves nothing good, right? Mm-hmm. So I felt that that was good for me to stay here. And plus, you have to give, you don't have to, but giving your art, giving my art and my concentration to a place that I stay is good for me, making a foundation, making a home, and then going, okay, well, I'm from Seattle. It used to be a time where I would leave Seattle and go, yeah, I'm from Seattle. But now, you know, because people would say, why you talk like that, you know, when I went down south, you know, and they would make me feel bad. How come you ain't from D.C.? You said Washington, and, you know. But now, you know, I know that we do have a talent here. We do have a really rich talent here. And it's about coming back to your home base. You know, there's nothing like coming to your homecoming or, you know, graduation, after you graduate and your high school's here and your college is here, or your family's here and your friends are here, you know. So I had thought about it. You know, yeah, I had thought about going to other places, and I've been other places, but what I found is that when I come home, it can be the most satisfying feeling because I know good people here who have my interest at heart. I also know people, you know, wherever you go, that don't have my best interest at heart. But that's where you get honest, mm-hmm. and you can tell people, you know, we don't need to be friends. We're in the same town, but we don't need to be cool. It's okay. But you can be honest with them like that. You know, I found that when I went to other places. People were real honest with me. I don't like you. Right. Yeah. Okay, you know, deal with the honesty of it, you know. That's what.
Excellent. So I want to really delve into some of these other questions that people have, because there are a lot of them. So we're going to bounce topics, because I'm just going to get right to them. And maybe I'll touch on education, because I see quite a few questions here. So someone wrote, what would you say in relation to being a black student having to leave communities for quality education and being a minority in the classroom? And I'm going to pose this then to Trish, because that is an issue for students here in Seattle.
It's an issue for students everywhere, mm-hmm. not just Seattle. You know, we have a segregated city when it comes to education, and we've allowed it to happen. Mm-hmm. So we have to first acknowledge that, right? As grown-ups, we have allowed it to happen. Those of us who could move out have moved out. Those of us who are staying, a lot of times families don't have the time or the wherewithal to really fight the system. So I think it's all of our responsibility, whether you have kids, whether you're an empty nester, whether you've never had kids, we all need to wrap ourselves around the schools and make sure that the resources are there. What you see on the north end is you see upper middle class families can have PTAs that draw $200,000 a year, right? My kids went to TT Minor for all of their elementary school, and I was the PTA president for 2 years. The most we ever raised was $5,000, right? You can't add a lot to that. Our state underfunds education. So we have to come together as a community and not let the system do this for us. We have to come together as a community and bring those resources. We also have to change our education system to make it work for this century, not last century. And to make sure that our kids are getting the kind of education they need to be successful. So right now, they're not. They're doing the sit and get. You know, Sage on the stage, I listen to what you say, you pour knowledge in my head, I either get it or I don't, and we move on to the next topic. We're not getting our kids ready for the kind of careers that we want them to have. We're not getting them ready to solve some of the problems that we, frankly, created for this next generation, right? It's a challenge that only we can solve. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to say the system can solve it. They don't have any need to solve the problem. They're a monopoly. What are we going to do, right?
And I guess Trish and Anthony, I'm going to pose this question to you, too. And I know you may have a longer answer than we have time for, but how do you, because, I mean, really, but how do you do that? I mean, I'm a parent. We moved to the CD recently. My daughter goes to a public school, but sometimes I feel like I don't want to be like the trailblazer. Maybe I just need to get her in a private school because I sort of feel this way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, don't worry, if my husband's in the audience, we're not going to do that. But Anthony, do you want to answer to that? Or Trish, do you want to talk to that?
I'm going to throw something out real quick. I had this idea 5 or 6 years ago, and it's a pretty radical idea, but I think it can be done. This school system, this particular school system, Seattle Public Schools, only reacts in crisis, right? When their back is against the wall, they do something. So I had this idea that I floated that on the day that they take attendance, which determines the budget for the year, we should all take our kids out, right? Because then the school district won't get any money, right? That's like the first week in October. There's a day where they take attendance. And then they get the money from the state based off of that day. And if we all took our kids out, it would get the attention of the school district, and then they would have to do something. You know, right now we have a group of people over at the Mann building that are trying to get attention. And it's a small group, right? And I'm not going to say whether what they're doing is right or wrong, but the point is they're bringing up some really good points, is that African-American students in particular in Seattle Public Schools have never been served well. So we in this room and everybody that's listening, if this is on radio or whatever, we all need to get together and figure out how we as a community really hold them accountable, but it has to be a steady flow. It can't be a march one day. It can't be holding up a building for a couple weeks. It's got to be like a big concerted effort. And that was the one way I could figure out to do it, was to take all the kids out of school. And then, you know, we can get nonprofits to take care of the kids for a couple of days, and they'd be no worse for the wear.
So, I love that. I'm going to just, I said we would wait to the end to do Q&A, but I see a couple of people who want to ask questions. I see you in the green shirt up there. If you want to come this way, and I also, gentlemen, you wanted to ask a question? Did you want to ask a question as well?
You can stand up. I really want to make a comment because God bless you for being involved. God bless you for being involved. I live about 50% of my time in New Orleans, and all the public schools in the city of New Orleans are black. When I was looking for real estate, the real estate agent said, well, that's a black school. And I said, in Seattle, we don't say that. No.
We do. We don't say
that. No, I don't. I don't.
It may not be said out loud.
We don't. I mean, because...
When
98% of the children in a school are black, and the reason, and there's plenty of African American kids go to private schools. In New Orleans, the Catholic schools are, there's millions of them. Every block has a Catholic school. You mentioned private school. But the only thing that's keeping those poor little beautiful children from getting a great education is the parents are not participating. When you said that, that was a beautiful thing. And really participating.
That's not what I was saying. Let me just be really, really clear.
Yeah.
There are 7 hours a day our kids spend in school. And for 7 hours every day, 5 days a week, 9 months out of the year, they belong to the public school system. They belong to the educators who should be doing their job to make sure they educate our kids. Absolutely. You know, when you think about when I'm 56 years old, when I grew up, my mom cleaned floors for a living. She didn't even graduate elementary school. Her job was to get me up in the morning and get me to school. The school's job was to educate me. And when I came home, My mother's job was to make sure that I got my homework done, even though she couldn't help me. We supported each other as kids, right? It's not like that anymore. They send home new work for kids to learn more outside of school instead of actually teaching during the school day for the 7 hours. Our kids should be working their butts off for 7 hours a day. They should come home tired, right? And they should learn everything they need to learn in those 7 hours a day. It is a myth, and it is a middle-class myth, that parents need to be so involved in order to make education right. It became a myth because middle-class parents could afford to do that, and so therefore educators didn't have to work as hard, right? And so that worked for them. It doesn't work for poor kids regardless of race. It doesn't work because their parents cannot support them. We have two educated people in my family running our house, college educated, one with a master's. I look at the homework my kids bring home, and I'm like, really? You have to learn this tonight? Right? I've got to help you do this new work, and I do help you because I can. But then I think about the parents who can't do it. So that is not what I was saying. I just want to make sure you understand that. Yeah, because we're blaming everybody. We all are to blame, right?
So we have a
equal weight.
We have a question from this gentleman in the green sweater. No, thanks.
Well, not necessarily a question, but a comment to what was being said, because I'm a single dad, and my son started at Renton High School. Now he goes to Lindbergh, and I'm not from here. I'm from Queens, New York. I've held several hats in Seattle. I've been a promoter. I'm a journeyman plumber. I'm in Local 32, Seattle, plumbers and pipe fitters. The educational part, what I'm seeing, I'm very involved in my son's school, but I'm up there every week because he's getting into something, or, you know, he hasn't matured yet into his age, so to speak. But my son never has homework. Every day my son comes, and this is, he started Renton High School last year, he's in Lindbergh this year, never has homework. And I'm mad because I had a whole lot of homework when I was a kid. That's the unfair part of the school system. But, you know, with him not having homework and me overcompensating, I'm barking at the teachers constantly. He needs homework. They'll sit there and say, okay, we'll work on it, but homework never comes home. Number two, in my plumbing role, I'm a journeyman plumber in Local 32. All of the big cranes that you see around the city, they're usually union jobs. I've been here since 2003. Every job I've ever been on in the city of Seattle, I've been the only black journeyman plumber on that job. There might be a couple of pipe fitters. There might be a couple of apprentices. For some reason, the school system in Seattle is not taking care of minority children and teaching them the skills to go into these jobs. Now, you might say, well, you're just a plumber. I make $51.26 an hour. Hold on. Let me reiterate that. Because I got locked up. Hold on, please. Let me give you the conjecture, because I got locked up on a driving under suspension charge a couple of months ago, transporting me from the SCORE facility to King County Jail to get processed. I just got into a conversation with the officer. Now, he had been on the job for 30-some-odd years. He said, you make $1.26 more than I do. There's African-American, other minority children that are not getting educated enough to the level of just going into an apprenticeship. And after 6 years, you could be making $51.26 an hour. But how come there's no other African-American men with me? It's because of the education system and the social and economical disadvantages is being set by the city of Seattle.
Thank you very much. I think we have some of our panelists who want to comment on that. Sean, you wanted to comment?
Well, I wanted to bring it back to something that you had said earlier about why exactly should it be that black people have to stay in Seattle. And you know, by the letter of the question, it's correct, right? I mean, nobody should have an obligation to have to stay anywhere. But then when we have conversations like this come up where people are talking about failing institutions or talking about things that aren't really going to go anywhere without generational systemic commitment, then I think you start to see why some people are as frustrated as they are with people, you know, black people coming, leaving in another 7 years, right? Because with every turn that that happens, that's less psychological investment. That's less of an investment that I think people pay in the well-being of the institutions of the city that they live in, basically. And that those things don't turn around unless, you know, I think, you know, anybody who's involved in politics here, even on the cursory level, could tell you that there's a big difference between the level of commitment between people who are here for maybe a generation or so going back and those that maybe are here to see what they can get as opposed to seeing what they can leave behind. And I think that if we're fortunate enough to have a black in Seattle panel in another 5 or 50 or 150 years, as long as people come to the conclusion that, well, if there's nothing keeping me here, then I'll leave, we're going to be talking about the same things, I think.
Sandra, you kind of gave a little face.
I just think that brown people have, and women, have been required to bear the burden all the time. And I often feel that sometimes I agree totally with what you're saying, but then there's the other part of me that wants this young poet sitting on the front row to go to New York and live her dream as she imagines it, but have a relationship that is so seductive with Seattle that she encourages other people to want this to be their home. I don't know that everybody has to, I know that's not what you're saying, but I think that there can be a more dynamic relationship between black people and the city. I think also what you're talking about, to me, the way I'm reading it, has more to do with systemic issues than the bodies that are physically here sometimes. And I don't think those are, I think those are connected, but I think we talk about, on a basic level, people staying here, but we're not talking about why they don't stay. We're not talking about the structural racism. We're not talking about the social connections that lack here, that every time I meet a black person in Seattle, they're like, oh my God. You know, that you are having the Black in Seattle panel and you're like, where y'all been? You know what I mean? Like I'm interested in the dynamism, and I know that you're not being reductive or anything like that in the comment, but I think that it's really complicated, and I don't necessarily know that everybody that moves to Seattle or everyone that's from Seattle has an obligation to stay in Seattle. And that's my only point. I think there's a lot of weight around the lack of freedom that people of color have experienced over time. And there's, to me, a grand desire to have as many options as possible. And one of those options can be to stay in Seattle because it's desirable. And all the other options can be around whatever you want them to be.
Yeah. Very well said. So I'm gonna move on to something that I see a couple of times here. And I'll read two of them. One says, what can whites do to show blacks that we care? And another one says, how white people and anyone of privilege can gain perspective on the black experience in Seattle, and how can we all shed light on that privilege in order to listen and learn? Mm-hmm. And Felicia, we kind of talked about that a little bit before the panel. So I'll start with Felicia.
What I was thinking about, I was thinking about, I heard this word a lot, Seattle's liberal. Seattle, then they put white liberal. And so I looked up the word that talked about, you know, the freedom and, of your mindset and things like that. And for me, when I had thought about liberal, I had thought about the unification of all people of nationalities of different colors and how wonderful that was, and everybody standing around and having a great time being unified. But the thing about it is that liberal is like white people take that definition for them as if to say, we are going to help. We are going to assist. How can we help? How can we be a part of? What can we do? How can we solve slavery for you? How can we come back and say we're good people? How can we do this? Sometimes you just need to observe from a distance. And that's the best thing. So, you know, when it comes down to, what can be done, you know, black in Seattle, and I see white people, I just go, I don't know, I don't get the reason for even being here. And that's not an insult to you. It's just that sometimes you need to think about and you need to hold back a distance from being involved, because what it does is it takes away from the culture. Like, I don't go to Beijing Opera to participate in the opera. I go to observe it because that is a cultural thing that they have that I'm like, that's a wonderful aspect. But if I go to African dance, there is nothing dancing on the floor but white women. And I understand the need to want to be involved in certain things, but sometimes in order for your culture to be sustainable, in order for your culture to be passed on to your children, you just have to understand that you're not welcome to everything. And a lot of times here in Seattle, what happens is you are blamed as a person of color, a black person, if you say you're not welcomed. And it's not that we're trying to be mean, which is like, you know, why are you being defensive? No, I have a right to be offended. Because if I say that this isn't for you, then you have to take that. You have to. Now, that's not a reversal of, okay, well, because being here in this country, we didn't have the right to do this, we didn't have the right to do that, we always had the right. What we had was people with guns and shit, you know. Excuse my language, I'm very sorry.
It's okay.
What we had was a strong, you know, what you were saying before, this whole thing of this equalism to animals as opposed to our humanity. And so that was taken away. So it takes time. You know, we are 125, 29 years behind the 300 years that Willie Lynch gave. So we are 429 years in it. He said it may be 1,000. So we got to really start looking at things and understanding that the mental process of it requires us to be able to sit with us and have discussions.
And what I'd like to, can I say, because I think I am kind of on this panel too. I want to say that this is what's so beautiful about our culture too, is that we aren't a monolithic, you know, culture. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that 100%, but I totally get where you're coming from. And all of the white people in the audience, you are welcome too. Here, I do want to
well,
say
I
that
see stuff like
because
that wasn't a diswelcome.
No,
was,
I completely understand,
you know
what you're saying.
But we always have to say, but you're welcome. You know, and that's what my thing is that, and it's not, it's to create still the discussion. Is that why do we always have to apologize for saying that you are welcome to be here when in fact sometimes you're welcome to be wherever you want to be, but sometimes you need to just stay back. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying
sure.
I don't know you personally to tell you where you need to go and what you need to do. I'm just saying that sometimes take the evaluation on yourself and just maybe, you know, take the time to sit back and just go, okay, there's going to be a forum today and maybe, you know, my participation isn't necessarily.
So, Sean, you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, that was a problematic question, to say the least. And I think the first thing that you have to think about is the notion that when you have a group of black people together talking about their experiences, that they're in need of help somehow. I think that seems to be the thing that a lot of us are objecting to, and I think it's pretty bogus. But I also think it's not too much to ask, or I hope it's not too much to ask whoever wrote that question to maybe identify themselves. Might be too strong a way of putting it, but we're up here putting a lot of ourselves on the line, right? There's a lot of, I don't know how many cumulative years of lived experience there is up here. We're putting it out on the line, and there's nothing anonymous about it. So I think that the question that was asked, one of the things that I find pretty troubling about it is that it can be that anonymous and that easy to put something such as that in the air. And if the answers that have been given, I guess, aren't satisfactory, that part of that you need to maybe go back and think about the premise of the question and come back another day.
Thank you. Yeah. Does anyone else like to comment on that?
I'll comment on it. I was a facilitator for an event at the Northwest African American Museum, and this white woman told the story about how she was at the grocery store in line, and the woman in front of her wrote a check. And then they asked her all kind of questions. The woman in front of her was black. They asked her all kind of questions. What's your ID? Give me this telephone number. Another ID. And the woman was like, okay, and the black woman finally made it through. But when she came up there, she wrote a check, and she was white. They asked her no questions. So she stopped the process and said, why, as a white woman, why did you ask me? Why didn't you ask me the same questions that you asked her? So one thing that white people can do is call it out when you see it's being done wrong. Mm-hmm. And I totally get what everyone is saying up here, but sometimes
we can talk as loud as we want to about what happens, but sometimes people don't listen to us. And sometimes we're not at the table for the discussion. If you're in a room and you're the only black person in the room and you didn't organize the event, you need the white person beside you to say, why is she the only black person in the room? So I need you to say something for me. And at the same time, I do understand, too, that I came from North Carolina. I've been here for 13 years. There are times where, yeah, North Carolina represent. it's two of us here. Ooh, no. But there are times where, and I have the most diverse friends ever in my life, being here in Seattle. And my dad comes and visits. He's like, I don't know who's going to show up for dinner. He don't know if they're going to be Asian, if they're going to be white. He has no clue. But there are times when 12 Years of Slaves come out, and I'm like, I'm not asking one of my white friends to go. And it's not because I don't love you. It's not because I don't think you should see the movie. It's because I'm going to need a minute to take it in. And that's just true. And I may not ask you to come see The Best Man either. But it's just, there are times when we need to be together as a community, and there are times where I feel as though black people are a little bit too open. We are too quick to say, and I think we got this from segregation and desegregation, is that, come on, we can be diverse. And then the first time I worked into a diversity meeting, it wasn't about race. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm from Delaware. Diversity is about race. But diversity became something else. So I think we're quick to say, let's be diverse, but at the same time, we're not feeding our own community. We're not feeding what we need to say to one another, what we need to be truthful about. How do you really feel about 12 Years a Slave? And don't sugarcoat it. Tell me how you feel. Type conversations.
Thank you. Another question that's kind of on that same track that I see a couple of. Someone wrote, in Seattle, there seems to be a tone of color blindness in which race issues are ignored. What do you feel could bring the topic of race equality to the forefront? And someone also says, hue of my skin does not make me inherently different. That kind of touches on the whole idea of diversity, and I think is something that I find that I'd never experienced in other places that I've lived, where I hear that more than anything else. Like, I don't see your color. I don't see your race. How can we live in a society where we not really bring this up because we're all the same? Trish, you,
Now, I worked in the diversity department at Microsoft for a year and a half, and I can tell you how many times I've heard that, and in my life now, we keep saying we all want to be the same, but what is the same? Like, what is that thing that everybody wants us to become is the question, right? I want you to honor me as me, as an individual, as an African-American, as a woman, as a lesbian, as a parent, as everything I am, and see all that, and recognize that I add to the fabric of this wonderful community. Mm-hmm. Just like I recognize you add, with everything you bring, I recognize you add to this wonderful community. I hate when people say I don't see color. I teach my kids to not like that either, you know, because it's, I don't want them growing up in this time where people don't see their color and they don't see, you know, who they are as individuals, and they try to treat them as something, because that means you're trying to put me in this box, and I don't belong in this box. And I know that for some people, they mean well when they say that, but it doesn't come off well. It just doesn't. It means you don't see me and you don't honor my culture. So please stop saying that, regardless of your race. Please stop saying that. It just devalues people. It really does.
I used to work at the Studio Museum in Harlem, and I remember one time the director, it's a museum that focuses on black culture on 125th Street, a block from the Apollo. And it's the first and probably one of the only black museums that doesn't just have historical material on view where you can try on some shackles or you can do that kind or see a slave ship or something like that. It's actually about the black creative experience. The artist, in whatever way that they want to be, wherever they're from in the world, black being, you know. And one of the things that was so important about my experience there was that every day I got to focus on blackness being complicated. And that he and I can have a difference of opinion, but we could still be rigorous, thoughtful colleagues. And he, as a black thinker, as a man, as a creative person, as a filmmaker, exists in his own right. Whereas I could also talk to somebody else that experienced, had the same kind of like baggage, thoughtful, whatever that they brought to the table, but they were complicated, and no two people in the world are alike. And I think sometimes when we're talking about our experiences, or people are in search of helping us, I think that they're thinking that there's one solution. And it's deep. Whiteness is complicated. There's a lot of writing about that, by the way. I mean, these are academic subjects that are studied in terms of the deconstruction of race in universities all over the world. As an example, my husband, who is Haitian, we come to Seattle, and he was born in Haiti. He is Haitian. He speaks Haitian Creole. We come to Seattle, we're both black Americans. I say that like funny, but that happens to the young people that are in the public school system here. Like, she is Somalian. She's black, but Asian. They exist. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that sometimes we have these conversations about, oh, just the skin color or brown or someone that's self-identifying with blackness. And there are black people that don't identify with blackness in the stereotypical sense. So I think that part of the discussion can be about blackness being complicated just like any other ethnic or racial or social group. And all of this is a social construct, by the way. That whole thing is...
Thank you for that. And Rawa Hopti was originally on the panel, and she could not make it here. Yeah. But that is another question that is on our piece of paper about how can blacks and Africans be united, but then also in a larger context, you know, really acknowledging our differences there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you made a very good point in that. It is 7:30. I can't believe it. I really want to get all of your questions as well. So I want to pose this question, how can blacks and Africans be united? And then I want to get questions from the audience. Mm-hmm. And anyone on the panel like to speak to that, or I can start in the audience and take it from there.
Yeah, my hand raised. I see him.
Yeah.
I'm so, like, they are connected.
Yes. So I'm going to take it to the audience now, and I have a gentleman who has his hands raised. So if you could stand up and actually come to me, because my mic doesn't get that far.
He's got a cane.
I know.
Do you want to take one of these?
You can walk with my hand. Yeah. I'm just, baffled. How can we talk in this room, in this city, and say about the even getting into a subject like race and solving, but not once, not have I heard the word class?
Yes.
Mentioned. And for the better part of my life, I've been aware that I am not just black. Though I am also poor. And there's, at least in my upbringing, it's a matter of pronunciation, maybe even spelling, that difference between poor and po. And there are some white folks in this room that know what po is too. And I am just very pontificially, I would like to be able to look around me at any one point and say that I have some white friends who are willing to go to hell to help me get out of the hell I'm in. And right next door to where I live, there's a church, I suppose, ostensibly, it's a black church. And they built a brand new, beautiful edifice. It's a beautiful church right there on Othello and Martin Luther King. And beautiful. And I live there, and every day for several years I go by there, and then I interact with the workers. And one of the things that I remember very pointed, not seeing, not one Not one person of color. There was no black person on that job as a worker. Not one. Here's a black preacher in a black church in the black community, and white folks are building it, and black folks are saying not a confounded thing about it. Mm. Now, the reason why that bothers me is because, I don't know, is Y. King in this room? I don't know. But we were building Rainier Beach High School, and the auditorium, the performing arts. And we fought like hell, both politically, socially, and otherwise, to get that place built, to name it, the Paul Robeson thing. Not one, except, yes, one black worked on that building, and that was Y. King. The reason why I bring that up is because, according to the man, Y. King would show up and get a check for half a day. But that was to satisfy you black folks that I put a black man on this job. But if you sit here all day and all night and the rest of the week and don't talk about what to do about these problems you're bringing up, you have sit here for no damn good reason.
Well, he brings up points about class. He also brings up points about economics. I mean, so I have some other people who want to ask questions too, but do you all want to respond to him?
I think let the audience.
Okay. Great. Oh, and you've got crutches too. Let's see if I can come up. You sure? I apologize for this. What's your name?
My name is Robert. And I just have like a, not a rage, but this is just really fiery right now. In that, sort of to echo my brother's comments over here, I feel like a point was kind of missed in a lot of respects. In that, so I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and went to school in North Carolina, and then I was a school teacher in Oakland, California for a while, and now I'm up in here in Seattle, and I've been here for 5 years. And I think one of the primary things that I see as being the source of that sort of angst that I feel right now is the lack of questioning. Like, my white brother or sister asked how they could help. And to me, that's sort of an entry-level question that I welcome. Like, I want more questioning about what the problem is. Seattle has the most diverse area code in the country. It also has the greatest level of disparity economically, healthcare-wise. You know, these things exist right here. And what that represents to me is a lack of questioning. It's too much of a comfort with that word disparity. Too little insight into the difference between disparity and racism and looking into what that means. And it just feels like the people here, I hate to generalize, just don't. They take too much comfort saying, we're diverse here. I was listening to a radio show that was talking about this area code situation, and I've never called into a radio show before, but I called 43 times trying to get in to talk to this person on the radio show because they brought up that statistic that I mentioned of this being this place having the most diverse area code, but also the greatest disparity in it being the most segregated. And people called in and just were vehement about, I look out my window and I raise my children here and I see all these different types of cultures. It's such a rich, vibrant place. Person, caller after caller, guess which area code all of those callers were from? The same area code, South Seattle, by definition segregated. And it just blew my mind that person after person couldn't wrap their head around that was the problem. Like that was the problem right there. I just couldn't wrap my head around it. People aren't asking the hard questions. People aren't raising their hands and saying, how can I help? What is the issue? It's it is just mind-boggling. So when you're talking about people who come here and why don't they stay here or whatever, that's a, I don't know if you ever heard the concept of stereotype threat or whatever. I don't feel safe in a place where people feel like they don't see color, because there are real world issues out there that are happening to me because of my color. And I need you, like my sister said here, to speak up to that, because I'm dealing with it every day and I'm so tired. So tired. Thank you for, sorry, that was a little
no,
bit of a
thank
rant.
You. No, thank you. I see some other hands. I'm going to start with this gentleman here, and then I'll take you, lady in the red.
My name is Reginald. I've lived here in Seattle pretty much all my life. But one of the things recently is that we don't vote locally. We vote nationally, but we won't vote locally. So all of us are upset and mad, but we need to look at ourselves and start voting locally, and we can change some things here in our own backyard.
Okay, I'm originally from Chicago, one of the bad parts, not...
South side?
South side, yeah, my family. So I'm originally from Chicago, and just a little bit about me is that I had to sort of learn to standardize to sort of make a little bit more money than I could have, you know, where I was. So I took myself and I placed myself in a better situation that, you know, I thought. And I started learning a little bit more about the world. And then I joined the Army. And after that, I quickly moved to Germany. And I found that there was a lot that I didn't know. A lot that I didn't know. After Germany, then Asia, and then here. So we're having this discussion, but, you know, I guess I see, from what I've seen in my travels, I feel like another issue that we haven't spoken about is culture. We're talking about black, but what does that mean? I am Jamaican. I grew up Poe. I am well-traveled. I am self-educated. You know, I have kinky hair. all these things, and I feel like these issues need to be addressed, but they need to be addressed with foundation behind it. It's like we're talking about black and we're talking about, you know, African culture. This is the most East Africans that I've ever seen, ever, here. And it's like what? I feel like the issue is a little bit convoluted because we don't have a standard culture to kind of push forward. I do think we have similarities and we do have some things that we can bond on, but nothing to say, you know, I'm black, and this is what that means. I spent a lot of time in Europe still having to standardize who I was because they thought that I was what they saw on TV. They thought that I was a 50 Cent video. They thought that me and Dave Chappelle hung out. I'm dead serious. I couldn't get, they were surprised that I'm, you know, intellectual. So I spent a lot of time presenting the image that I wanted them to know, and it wasn't necessarily black, it was American. So
well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but yeah, it is complicated. I mean, you talk to that, that we're not just one.
Would you like to speak? Behind you then.
There's one right there.
I'll get to you just one second, and then this woman here, so. You'll let your, yes, your elder. Dr. Elder.
Hey, that's who I am now. When I came to Seattle, almost 40 years ago, and I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I'm also Bayesian and all of that. And I came here, I lived in Bellevue. There was one bus that came to Seattle and one that went back. But anyway, cut the story short, get down to it, is that consider myself a community activist, and how I got involved is because I have three children, and two males and one female, and I didn't want them to die. And so what I did was I got involved in the community. I don't see anybody here there, okay, is what I want to say. For the past 15 years, I have been in the community to save my children's life. and my children are still alive. That's because I let the Seattle Police Department know who I was, and they knew who my children were. Okay? And the only time that we can have any action is if we get involved. I'm always the only Negro at the table, okay? You need to come and join me. If you want to make change, you have to get involved in the community. They say that black folks, I'm still living in the CD, thank the Lord. Okay, but black people can live in the CD. They just don't know. You got to get educated and find out what's going on. And I have to say something right now here, but to you, Ms. Mosley, because I am the vice president of the Central District Neighborhood Council, and I'm on the nominating committee for new candidates.
New people. Uh-oh.
And do you know I'm with this man? There's two other whites, and I'm the only black. And they have been chasing her down to be on the committee. Now, she hasn't even been in the community any period of time, but they want to make her an officer because of who you are. Now, that's crazy to me. That don't make no sense because she needs to be indoctrinated into community, what's happening, what's going on.
I have been here for 8 years, and I do live in the CD. And I am very good friends with the gentleman you're talking about. So there you go.
But the whole thing, though, what's happened is he's making you the secretary, and he's going to make the two other people white that are president and vice president. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. If we're so diverse, we must keep the diversity within what's happening.
Well, let's talk about it afterwards, okay?
No problem.
Thank you. You wanted to speak? All right now. So, okay. Yes.
Hi.
Peace to you all.
Can I hold this?
Okay. What up, what up, what up? Seattle for the race here.
All right. So one, looking at this, so I have just a couple of things really quick. One, looking at the panel, this is a direct reflection of what it feels like to be young and black in Seattle. There are no young voices on this panel. So.
How old are you?
I myself are 20.
Okay.
Right. So I'm still considered a
young.
Right. You appear young, but I'm still considered a youth. Right. So one, this is what it feels like to be black in Seattle. Youth voice is not represented equally. It's like if you're young and black in Seattle and you're dealing with all the things that happen to young black people in Seattle, it doesn't really matter. Right. I mean, that's what we see. Nobody was invited to be on this panel who was a young person directly involved and working with youth in Seattle.
I work with you.
So,
young
and youth.
I'm saying that to emphasize her point because there are amazing young people in this room that work with youth as youth activists.
Right. So thank you. Secondly, when we're talking about education and the disparity within education in the Seattle Public School District, we're not recognizing the fact that we are continuously trying to have our children excel within a system that is not made for them. And so we are denying the fact that this is a white supremacist system that we're trying to send our children of African descent into, rather than collectively coming together, creating a curriculum, implementing it for children of African descent. We're also not addressing that most of the youth who are my age are from a generation of people, of black people in Seattle affected by crack cocaine, who have had to raise themselves, essentially, who are parents to children like myself, because I have a child myself who has to raise this young black man. I'm deciding to be a young black person who is an artist and activist in Seattle, leave Seattle and do work elsewhere, come back home, be rejuvenated, come back home whenever I want to, but really to be connected to the African diaspora, because black folks in Seattle, to me, seem to have to learn how to be black in Seattle. And you shouldn't have to learn how to be black in Seattle. You should be black in Seattle, walk and be black, but when you're surrounded by whiteness, that's a little hard. So when we're coming to this conversation about being black in Seattle and asking adults what it means to be black in Seattle, we are not talking about what it means to be black in a hostile environment that is white in Seattle.
Thank you. So I do want to say before I take someone else's comments, And I have a line here, and I see all of you all in the middle. I do want to say that this is the first of KUOW has committed to a series of forums where we can talk. We can talk about the youth in Seattle. We can talk about the education system. We can talk about the LGBTQ community and what it means to be a transplant. So I want to let you know that we do have the floor now. And I also want to say, in putting together this panel, it was just kind of me. So I'm learning about all of you guys. And then the next round, we will continue to have more voices.
Can
I just have to say that. Yes.
Can I have the opportunity to respond to her?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Go ahead, Sean.
First of all, you had mentioned that there aren't many young voices represented up here. My 29th birthday was on Friday, so I'm a little bit troubled that I'm like, it's just from young to old, and it took just one birthday to get there. You know, the other side of it, too, is that I was born 2 days after Ronald Reagan was elected for the second time. So, and you're speaking very eloquently and from the heart about the effect that crack cocaine had on a lot of communities of color in our community in particular. I think that one of the things to keep in mind is that if it's already set up for you that Seattle is a white supremacist city, white supremacist institutions, it's hard to argue that. But if you come to that approach that there's no agency whatsoever, there's no way for you to find ways to assert your personal voice, right? That if voting doesn't matter, if coming to a panel such as this where, you know, we're all old, I guess, if that doesn't matter, then what you're going to do is you're going to run up continually against certain boundaries, right? And this happened to many people in the late 60s, right? People who were very radical at an earlier point in their politics, who found themselves going into a situation where people who voted for the most radical candidates in 1968, 6 years later, were some of the harshest conservatives that you would ever meet. And it's because all of those walls were set up where they couldn't see possibilities, to the point where they couldn't see possibilities anywhere. So I think I'd just temper the approach a little bit that says that, you know, a white supremacist city by definition, even though we've had, you know, the UNIA has been established here, the Nation of Islam has found a cause to be established here at some point, the NAACP, like, if you run down the line, there are a lot of organizations that are as quintessentially black as you can get, and they've all found a foothold here. So if it's good enough for the Nation of Islam or the UNIA or the NAACP, it should be good enough for you too. How did you find this, if I could ask?
I'm part of this. I'm directly a part of Washington Hall. I'm directly connected to a lot of the activists in this room and have worked in collaborative spaces with a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So that's why I have accessibility to this information. I told my 15 youth that I had downstairs, from Southwest Interagency, from Rainier Beach, from Garfield, to all of the rest of the high school, did they know anything about a conversation about being black in Seattle?
Whose fault do you blame? And I don't think that there's necessarily blame to be assigned, but...
We'll continue with that. I want to get everyone's questions, so we're going to...
Can we stay here for just 1 second? Because I think that this is such a powerful thing. Sorry whoever else is upset about this, but I think the collaboration between, you said the word yourself, between adults and young people sometimes doesn't happen. And I think that relationship oftentimes is filled with tension because the power dynamics are at play in unusual and problematic ways. There are cultural norms, like the sister that came over that said, you know, no, let an elder speak. And you were like, yes, 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 you know. Like, I mean, there are norms that we learn in our communities that are relative. I think sometimes because of bad relationships that have existed, we carry that over into every experience. I know that I did. So, as an example, my mother's from rural Mississippi. There are five of us that grew up in my family. Everybody ended up on drugs except me. The reason why I knew not to do drugs was because I saw what happened. My mother never used drugs, but all of her kids except me did. So the reason why I bring that up is because that actually spoke to the collaboration that my mom and I had. And I think that you're right. A youth voice should be up here. And I think that integrating panels like this with young people's voices would actually temper or change a lot of what the frustration that you're articulating. But I also think that there's an imperative that we all not kind of continue to perpetuate the dichotomy that seems to be at play here. And I think, because I know that that's not, this, she's one of the most talented young people in this city and speaks to social justice issues in every bit of her work and uses her voice to tell these stories. But out of frustration, she's up here pissed because there isn't a youth voice up here. So I hear you, but I think from this side of the table, having been you, not you specifically, but you at some point in your life, a black woman in a body, I can tell you I know that frustration, but I also know collaboration from the other side. I just reached that tipping point where I don't have the youth street cred anymore, and you will be there someday too, sitting up on this panel. So I'm just, you understand what I'm saying? So I think that it's just a beautiful opportunity for us to hear from a young person who actually ends up putting herself on the panel. So,
yes.
So first and foremost, I'd like to thank the panel for actually taking the time to come out. And I also like to thank everyone who showed up because, once again, there's power in number. And I'm glad to hear that there's so much emotion and a lot of vigor and passion with everyone's responses. What I wanted to add to this conversation was kind of piggybacking off of what everyone else was saying, but kind of bringing more light to it in terms of education and what's being taught in our schools. I often tell people the thing that plagued African Americans is how we are taught history. More importantly, if you look at any elementary or high school textbook, they tell you that the world started in 1492, and there were whites and there were you. Then they skip 300 years to the Revolutionary War. There were whites, there were you. Then they skip another 200 years to the Civil War. We let you free, but whites were here, you were here. Then they give you these sob stories about Black Revolution and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, who were assassinated. Then they tell you how there was revolt after that with the Black Panthers, and then they tell you that Huey P. Newton was a crackhead and that the CIA infiltrated the Black Panthers to dissolve them. And then they tell you about more youthful or inspiring revolutionaries like Tupac and Biggie, the ones who developed a culture, and what happened to them? They got shot. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because it brings out this idea of self-esteem for the Black community. Because now you are told from the beginning that you are nothing. But more importantly, if you try to be something, we will kill you. Now, as I said before, when you read history books, they skip a lot of content. And it's important to understand that a lot of that is not true. There is a lot of content in between those years, a lot of slave revolts, a lot of great things that happened in those years that are not being taught to our youth due to accessibility, as she said. But that's where we come in, because they're not going to teach it in these schools. You have to educate the youth. You have to educate yourselves, because if you do not know your history, it's very fundamental. If you do not know where you've been, you do not know where you're going to be and where you can go.
So I have some people in the middle that have been raising their hands for a while, and then I have you guys along the side. So I'm going to have you step up. Yep, and if you'd like to say something.
I totally agree with you, and I don't think we should let schools off the hook. Schools can do a lot better, because the reality is that most people aren't going to be able to catch up with that history to teach their kids, but it is the schools, the education system's responsibility to tell the truth. And that's one of the things that we can put pressure on them to do, is to tell history from the side of other people. One of the things we do in our school is we encourage our kids to look at the people who were colonized. Right, so one of the questions we would ask our ninth graders is, what role did science, technology, engineering, and math play in the European colonization of the world, right? And then they would take different countries that were colonized and look at it from their viewpoint, including here. And it's a different way to teach because you're opening their mind to their own research, and they're using their own thoughts and their own hands and their own ability to come to the conclusion of the truth. But if you just teach from the book and go by what the book says, you get exactly what this young man said. So we need to push the schools to teach in a different way and let the kids discover on their own with some guidance what the real truth of the history of our whole universe is.
I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you to the panel. And I pray to God this young lady didn't leave because I really wanted to say something to her. Number one, there's a row full of people that I'm sitting with who are involved in the Urban League building, which is right across the street, that was established in 1930, that is in this public community, does speak out on civil rights and different information. And my division, Education and Youth Empowerment, gave a $2,500 scholarship out to a youth last year from Renton, and we've done that for 5 years in a row. I want to speak to this young lady about the possibilities for volunteerism. But the other young people in the room from ages 21 to 40 or younger or older, I can connect you to somebody if you don't know. But Trish also is connected to the Technology Access Foundation. There's MESA. There's more than one thing. But the Seattle Urban League for Young Professionals, I would encourage people, if you've just got here, if you're a transplant and you've moved from somewhere, wherever, I don't care. And you don't even necessarily have to be black. If we're talking about uniting a culture or creating a culture from the young lady who was in the Army, thank you for serving our country, to just unite here, get on sulyp.org and look it up. There's five different committees that you can be a part of, civic engagement and different things of that nature that seem to intrigue this young lady is one of those things. And I just want to say that sometimes, even though there's an age gap or a different institutional knowledge does help us to have some of our roots or have some of, you know, your fruitful experience to teach us. And how can we tell sometimes what age people are? People don't know what age I am, but I'm 35. I'm not in my 20s. You know what I mean? But it's hard to approach that. So just please be clear that there are some options for volunteerism or things to look into, and they're right here. And the crazy part is, part of it is right across the street.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hello. I just wanted to say I'm from Seattle, born and raised. I moved to Georgia for several years, and it's when I returned to Seattle that I realized that there was something missing here for a black, as it relates to a black community. But I will tell you what we can do to help others understand what it is we go through as black people. No, we don't want to be invisible. We don't want to be considered. It is dishonest when you say you don't see color, and that is in some ways offensive when you say you don't see color, because that's like one of the ladies said, you're not seeing me. And so I work at the University of Washington on a floor where I am. I think there's 60 people, and I'm two blacks on the floor. And my boss is she's one of the top people at the University of Washington, number three at the University of Washington. I'm not going to name any names because I like my job. Okay. But she, one day she was talking about how hard it is for her. She's an intellectual and an introvert. And she was talking about how hard it was for her to be on for social activities. You know, she just really just takes all of her energy out of her. And she's like 70 years old, white lady. I don't get PC too often. And only when it's necessary. I know when and how to talk, so I won't be PC right here. And there was another white lady there, 60 years old, and she says, yeah, I'm the same way. I just get exhausted with social activities. And it just came to me, and I just said it. I said, you know what? That's why I'm so tired when I go home from work every day, because I'm on. At the University of Washington, you don't necessarily get to be a black person. Do you know what I mean? Every day at any job where you work in corporate America and here in Seattle, Washington, you have to be a little different than what you are every day at home. And when I go home every day, I'm exhausted from being on every day. But you know what? What I give to those two white ladies over 60 years old? They listened to me, and they talked to me, and we had a wonderful conversation about the whole thing. Because for them, they never realized that there was a difference. Do you know what I mean? That's called that white privilege, something that they don't have to look at as a white person. So what I say to you, if you can find an educated, respectful way to bring these issues up to your colleagues or people, do it. Sometimes they just have no idea what you go through every day as black people. And she's the one who told me about this panel tonight.
There you go.
That's something, Sean, you were talking about, the duality, and I mean the dual consciousness. Come on.
Okay, hello. As y'all know where I work, but I also do other things in the community. I specifically work with a lot of youth and young adults. And so what I really want to encourage is, like, I think we always forget, like, some people don't want to talk about trauma and hardship, but it's also important to talk about. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of sexual assault and domestic violence work, and what we don't really talk about is about resilience and, like, the resilience of young people, no matter what we look like or what we're wearing. But, like, as a community, I identify as black and Filipino, is that as black people, we have continuously struggled, but we've also been resilient all these different ways. And so when we think about culture and we think about resilience, we think about food and where our food comes from. That is about survival. That is about resistance as well. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about my cultures and when I started to learn, like, it's not hard. It's like it's very traumatizing to learn about history when we see books like post-traumatic slave syndrome and what are the effects of what's happening today and trauma in all aspects. But also we have to look at the resilience. And so when I think about how much black people have also stood up for other people, when we're like, what is happening to African-American people can also happen to you. And when we talk about what actually connects us and our resilience and resistance is, like, for me and my cultures is, like, I think of, like, the history of what African-American people did within the Philippines to resist colonization and saying, don't let that happen. Like, when we hear about black famous activists that were here in the United States, they were also resisting imperialism and colonization as well. And these are the things that we need to teach young people, because, like, it's traumatizing to hear about what actually happened to all of us, or even people within the United States, what happened to indigenous people here. But it's all connected, and we actually supported each other. And that's also a part of history that is missing. Yeah. And I also want to think that we also created something out of nothing. And so when I think of the arts and what people are creating, is like, why can Moni sing so well, right? And we're like, because she rapped, what I see her doing as well as other people, artists, is like, we wrap that pain and we make it beautiful. And that's what jazz is, that's what hip hop is, and, like, remember that resilience as well. So.
How you doing? I just wanted to speak real quick. I'm born and raised in Seattle also. And being black in Seattle is not like being black in Mississippi. It's not like being black in Chicago. It's not like being black in New York. And I went to Atlanta for less than a year and came back. Because I wasn't as black in Atlanta. Macon, Georgia. So it's just, but one of the issues growing up here, my first hindrance was the education. I lived in the Yesler Terrace. My mother shipped us to the Lake City. I went to an elementary school in Lake City. She thought she was doing the best for me. But then they classified me with a learning disability, and most of my memory is in a closet when the spelling and everything. So I didn't learn that I had a deficit until I got to college, and they told me, well, these rules you should have learned in elementary. And I said, oh. Now, granted, being black in Seattle, we are presented with opportunity that those other places don't have. I know. I visit. Came back. We are granted opportunities. Like this man said, plumber, 10th grade education, you go through the apprenticeship program, you're making more than the police. But that opportunity is just held out to us so far. I worked in the industry, construction industry. I did my internship at the Urban League, across the street. I came from poverty, like I said, Yesler Terrace, which I thought was the ghetto till I went to Brooklyn. and learned that the opportunity that Brooklyns have is that they're gonna be successful there, and across the street, there is no opportunity. for them to be successful, like here in Seattle. Being black in Seattle, we actually have the opportunity to take back the Central District if we want it, because there's enough of money here in black people in Seattle to actually do it.
Say that one more time, brother. You can take it back.
We can take it back if we want it.
I'm from Queens, New York. That's my brother. So he'll let me interrupt him. Now, there is no way an 18 double hockey stick that I would leave Seattle. Because when I came to Seattle 3 months later, I had a business. You can do it here, but see, there is no black community here. There's other promoters just like I was promoting, right?
Let me get you on that.
What do we do? We bump heads every time we see each other. If the police aren't trying to shut us down from
I'm going to ask you to get on the mic. So if you, give just a second and come right here. And I want you to say, to finish what you're saying. And I also want to let you guys know that we have about, 30 more minutes. So I definitely want to get everyone who's waiting to say something. So if you can wrap it, yep.
I want to wrap up because I have a multiracial family now. I got a mixed marriage. My wife and her kids is from California, American Mexican, which I thought, hey, we just gonna all groove and come in and come up to Seattle. And she told me straight up, this is different. This is different from what her experience is. And I didn't know how different it was until now. I'm speaking, I got a 20-year-old. We just hung out for the last 2 days. What we talk about? Racial equality. And I say, well, just let's stop the equality. There's a superiority and there's an inferiority. And for me to advance, it's being withheld. And I have to learn a different language to get where I want to go. And I have to encourage her because she's 20 years old and I want her to be successful. And I say, we're kind of spoiled here as coloreds in Seattle. The division is there. It's white and then coloreds. But born and raised from Seattle, we are spoiled, and it's just the opportunity is just always held away from us. So we don't seek solutions.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have you come on.
My name's Kai Velasquez. I've been in Seattle since I was 2, so I'm from here as far as I'm concerned. And thank you for doing this series. I don't really feel like there have been a lot of voices of black people who are from here.
Mm-hmm. Well,
in Columbia City, pre-gentrification, bus to Ballard to go to West Woodland, then bus to McClure in Queen Anne, then I finally ended up at Franklin in Mount Baker. But I think if we're continuing a conversation, my question to transplants who have come here is, what exactly was your expectation or what was your hope? Because as the gentleman said, we're not in Atlanta, we're not in Detroit, we're not in Brooklyn. I lived in Brooklyn in Crown Heights pre-hipster. I also lived in Oakland, but you know, we're not a predominantly black city. So what I'm really curious to know is, what was your expectation and what was your hope as a black person in Seattle? I've been here, I love it, I'm raising my family here, and I don't plan to go anywhere.
Now a transplant.
Now another transplant. I commend all of you. Thank you, panel. Thank you for what you just said. I think I want to address something you said a little while ago. My name is Mo Spencer. I'm an attorney. I do criminal defense and family law. There's about 100 people behind me that helped me to get to where I'm at. I practiced here. I've only been here a year. I was in Eastern Washington. You think there's a dearth of black folks here? Okay. They heard me out east. And I was in Vancouver as well. I've represented people on addiction, crack, heroin, you name it. One of the things, and I'm originally from Trinidad and Tobago, and I grew up in Houston. When you're in the Caribbean, the doctors are black. Mm-hmm. The politicians are black. The lawyers are black. So you grow up knowing you can really be anything. Moved to Houston, grew up in Houston. And I've been to Chicago, I've been to Atlanta, what have you. And what I see, and what did I expect when I came to Seattle? Maybe a more cohesive and unified black community. And I think that's what I don't see. I didn't see it in Portland. I went to law school in Oregon. I didn't see it in Portland. I think Portland's a lot worse, but that's a whole nother thing. But I think here it's unity. I think there is a black community, no question about it. I just don't think it's unified. And I think you can do a better job, we can do a better job in unifying. And when you unify, this is a great start. These people on the panel right here are a great start. And when you become part of the Urban League, and when you become a part of organizations, and then you slowly do grassroots, and you slowly elect people, and you slowly get somebody in the presidency like Obama. How many of you were going to go out and vote for Hillary until Obama was there? Because that grassroots that happened in 08 was amazing. And so what you're looking at is you've seen years after years, whether it's in Oakland, whether it's in Houston, of people getting together, doing grassroots, whether it's legal, political, medical, and they're getting together in a cohesive group and sitting down at a table, at a panel, and coming together, and then slowly you start seeing changes, and slowly you start seeing people protest, and then you do it in a cohesive manner, and then you start seeing results. And I've lived in Brooklyn, and when you see things done well, you see togetherness and unity. So it's here, I just think it just needs to be more unified.
Thank you.
Thank you. I respect you all for being here, especially my sister here, Black Stacks, amazing group. I just want to say there's so much irony in this conversation because to be Black in Seattle is not to be a scholar. Being Black in Seattle is being uneducated on the streets, and it's not as worse as it is in Brooklyn. And can I actually hold it because I kind of feel it's kind of difficult to talk. Can I hold it? Sorry. Being Black to me is not being scholarly because I went to college, my friends didn't go to college. There's so much disparity between those who can get into a university in the city and those who can't. So to be Black in Seattle is not really being a scholar. If this panel was represented differently, I would feel more comfortable being at this conversation. But honestly, I don't. I don't see any East Africans here. We are considered Black. East Africans Black too. We're not African, we're not other, we're Black. We're treated the same here as we are in any other place in this country. So if I saw a youth here, like my sister was saying, who left, if I saw a different kind of African here who came from the country, the continent, just recently, this would be a different panel. But I have not felt that I've been at a panel of Black Seattleites. I feel like I've been at a white, diluted, scholarly, very, very...
Well, I'm going to have to jump in on
filtered.
That.
No, I'm just saying my piece. Like you said earlier, we all have our own opinions.
No, go ahead.
But what I feel is all of this has been diluted because when you talk about education, why are we depending on the Seattle Public School District? That doesn't do anything for us. We have Africatown, which I have been heavily a part of. Africatown is changing the curriculum for our Africans and not relying on the school district to change that for us because we have no reason to rely on the school district. I'm sorry.
So the reason why. So a couple of things. One is that I totally appreciate what you're saying. However, to call me and the other people up here whitewashed is extremely problematic to me. Even the conversation, because I feel like just because someone is articulate and can talk about a whole myriad of things that reference everything from W.B. Du Bois and code switching and all of that. I'm not saying it's against you.
I'm just saying I don't feel comfortable with this conversation.
I understand
that's
that.
My right. I have the right to feel
I
that
totally
way.
Appreciate that.
I can't sit there and act like I'm at a conversation with Black Seattleites when I feel like all of you are very articulate and smart. That's not being Black in Seattle. That's being Black.
That's not true.
Hold on 1 second.
And I do want to let you know there was an East African representation.
If you can hear me, clap once. If you can hear me, clap twice. If you are invested in this dialogue, just shh for a second. The reason why I had a visceral response to that was not because of what you were saying, but it was because, it was a part of what you were saying. But it was, wasn't necessarily, I hear what you're saying about there isn't an equitable representation of Blackness on this stage. And we kind of talked about that a little earlier. We would be filling the state of Washington also with individual bodies if we were talking about the complex notion of Blackness. Hold on. The other thing is the reason why I don't have any children, but if I had children, I don't know that I would send them to Seattle Public Schools. I don't know that I would, but I feel like I have every right to send a kid to public schools because I pay my taxes. I feel like there is something that we forget about the fact that we are participating in fueling the economy here. But in addition to that, we need programs like Trisha's because we know that there's a deficiency there. But I do have problems with someone standing up here and saying that this is all whitewashed because
we're educated.
We're educated. And I think that's a myth. I think that's right. A problem. That is actually perpetuating a stereotype that is not real. There are a bunch of people that I see in my community and in my own house when I was growing up that weren't necessarily as articulate, quote unquote, as I am, but they could actually navigate a whole other system in a totally different way, and they were educated in another way. I just think it's. I don't think that black in Seattle means that you're inarticulate. In fact, I would say that the black people in Seattle that I've run into, and I feel that there is a black cohesive community on some levels in Seattle, I think that people speak standard English here in ways that I've never heard anywhere other black people in the rest of the country. I mean, people chop up sentences everywhere else in the world. It's like, my brother this, my sister. I mean, everything has a UH on the end. And in Seattle, there is an ER. And so I just think that there's something that we don't talk about. And I mean, we can have that dialogue about that a little later, but that's a little problematic to me.
Yes.
Hi, so my name is Acadia Salisbury, and I have 2 points. So my first one is that being black and young, and I actually go to a private school that's predominantly white, and thinking about where I'm going to go to college next year, I've been having this whole dilemma, especially growing up in Seattle, between do I actually want to have the experience of being in a community and being in a classroom where I'm surrounded by black people who look like me, because my entire education, having spent half of it in private school and the other half of it in public schools in Seattle, I've been the only black girl in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so having to choose and having that in mind is that if I choose to go to Spelman and I want a job on the West Coast, is that going to have the same notability? Am I going to get the same recognition as if I go to UPenn?
Yes.
And having to get a job for that.
Yes.
And I guess my second point would being is I've had the opportunity to travel. I've been to 3 continents so far in my life, and what's been a big question for me is where does the black culture fit in on this global community? Because when I go places, people have this like, oh, you're American, and I have like dialogues with people and I'm like, I'm American, but my American experience is not the one that that's been perpetuated to you.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you, as the panel, say does the black culture fit on this global community and this globalization?
Sean?
I'll let someone speak about the global part, but I want to address the historically black college and university part. I attended Delaware State University, which is a HBCU, which is in the, if you don't know, it's in the MEAC conference, which is with Howard, North Carolina A&T, Bethune-Cookman, FAMU, all those schools. And then I came to Seattle simply because, and then I ended up at Seattle U years later. And it sometimes breaks my heart, because I have family members. My nephew said that he did not want to go to an HBCU, that he didn't think he could succeed at an HBCU, that he was going to party too much at an HBCU, and he preferred to go to UNC Charlotte. And it crushed my heart, because there are a lot of us that are professionals that have worked our behinds off to get our education that our people fought for us to have. My grandmother cleaned floors. My grandmother was a top-notch Social Security worker and never had an education. My mother cannot read, so I fought for my education. And whether I get it at Howard University or if I get it at the University of Washington, the University of Chapel Hill, Duke University, nothing can stop you from getting the job that you want if you want it. Go get it.
That's right.
It's not about where you get your education from. It's about what you do with that education once you get it. It took me 13 years to get the job that I have today in running the CD form. 13 years. There was times where I didn't have food on my table when I was eating at my friend's house, but I was working at Langston Hughes for the city. So don't tell me you can't do what you want to do. You can do it no matter where you get your education from. Just go get your education. And if you can't go get your education, go learn a trade. Because there are people out there that don't have education. My mother is the smartest woman I know. She can take you up and down the East Coast. And she can't read a lick. She can't read not one sign. She can barely tell you the letters. But that don't mean she's stupid. That don't mean she hasn't worked 20 years at a factory, 30 years at a factory, 50 years at a factory. Just go do it. As black youth, as black adults, because you can do it too. Just go do it. Do what you want to do. This past weekend was my birthday. I wanted to go country line dancing. My black friends and my white friends said, "You're crazy." I did it. I have fun because I wanted to do it. Go do it.
There you go.
Did you want me to make a comment? The second half of her question was about where black culture, I think, fits into a global picture. As a black filmmaker, as a black artist, I think one of the things that I've always drawn a tremendous amount of inspiration from is that what we've put into our art has always been just a few years out ahead of what was actually in existence, right? So before whites and blacks in this country had more harmonious relationships, right? We had ragtime that showed that you could put the African influence right next to the European influence and have a cohesive form. To take hip-hop as another example, right? Before, people mired in the middle of what the young sister here pointed out is the crack cocaine epidemic. Before people were able to make it out of that, they were essentially illustrating a world where they were already prosperous. So I think that's one of the things that I would always look to is seeing what black creators were able to do as far as if it wasn't perfect in the moment while they were creating it, we were always able to project out a little head and speak it into being before it could actually come into being.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Deshaun Rogers. Great segue from what she was speaking about in terms of education. It doesn't have to be in an institution for you to educate yourselves. And so here's education for everybody in the room. I'm from North New Jersey. I have a master's just finished in Houston in statistics and genetics. And now I'm here. And I studied cancer research for prostate cancer for African Americans because nobody else was doing it because it's not lucrative. Okay? So we're here now. Everybody's going to go home in a minute. You're about to eat something. Here's free education for you. I'm telling you from my own personal research, my own education through school and out on my own books. If you go to McDonald's after you leave, and I just told you, the black in Seattle, for me, when me and my wife came here, we thought about all the fruits and vegetables and fresh fish we was going to get, and you don't get access to that. And you can get that type of stuff here with food stamps, so there's no excuse. So when you leave here today and you're going to feed your families, make sure that decision is something fresh, something healthy, and take care of your bodies. That's my education for you.
Thank you. This gentleman here, and then I have you here, and then you here. And then I think we're wrapping it up. So, okay.
I'll try to make this short and concise. So I moved here from Houston, Texas when I was 14 years old. I'm 30 now. And so the lady over there asked the question about, like, what do blacks expect when they're here? I know for me, I expect community. I look forward to going home to Houston every single year because when I step off that plane, I feel community. I feel the love of my black people. And I feel like one of the things I do love about Seattle is the fact that it is such a melting pot. You have white people, Asians, I have all different types of friends, and I love that. But I feel like black people here have melted too much where we've lost ourselves. You can have all different types of friends and still hold on to who you are. And I feel like the black people here are a little bit lost. They have melted so much that they no longer know who they are. And that's that feeling of emptiness we have here. I feel like that's where that feeling of emptiness is coming from, where you don't have a community, you don't have your own. Like, I miss black people when I'm here. And it's not that I don't love my white friends, my Asian friends. Like, I just miss, like, I mean, it feels good to be in this room with so many black people. And I think that you can tell that we've melted so far. You have this young lady who had the scarf on. For her, educated black people, and you guys just warmed my heart. I love it. Educated black people didn't really feel like the black experience to her. Like, that didn't feel like black people. And it's you don't get to see that here. You don't get to see black doctors, you don't get to see all of these different classes of black people here. You're told what it is to be a black person, to be a black person here. Many times I've had white people tell me, oh, well, you know, the black experience. Well, hold up. How do you know what the black experience, I know that they're trying to identify and connect, but how do you, it's not just one experience. We don't all just experience this one thing. And so it's just, I just feel like there's a lostness here in Seattle. And I love that we're trying to bring that together and have all different types, rich, poor, middle class. We have that connection in being black Americans, and we need to pull that back together a little bit.
Thank you. So we have two more comments and then wrap up, and then,
I will also be brief and just respect everyone's time and just want to shout out everyone who's still here. Given the time and people have families and the sacrifices, it's clearly a very important conversation. This may come off a little strange, but I'm going to do my best with it. One of my favorite parts of this evening is that everyone isn't on the same page. And I really like to challenge the notion that all black folks have to be on the same page. Because it's really apparent in my own personal life and where I'm from, but also just sitting in this room, that there are so many different types of black people, you know? That's just very real. And there's folks like the attorney that says he's from Trinidad, and folks said, I see a lot of folks from Houston here, people who are East African. The lady with the who spoke her comment that sort of struck a nerve said she didn't see East Africans in the room. There are East Africans in the room. But we don't have to be on the same page. But I'm excited to see folks who aren't on the same page not killing each other. You know? I'm from Detroit. Before I even got in the car, there's just so much homicide in other cities. Being black in Seattle often, and this is not, it's not across the board, puts you at a place where you are a little bit safer than black folks in Detroit or in New Orleans or in Atlanta or in wherever Trayvon was or in Miami, places that I've lived, Chicago, South Florida. So on a certain level, my family, who's in Detroit, it says, whatever you got going on with that job, you keep that because we love, you know? And they're like, we love you. My family's like, we love you, but if you never live in Detroit again, we ain't mad at you, you know? And so just embracing that and just embracing the experience, but also just being comfortable in the discomfort. Yep. I'm glad Felicia's on this panel. You know, I'm glad to see all of you on this panel. But just really, just in brevity, just respecting the fact that we are different and that that's okay. And then we're conversing because a whole lot of folks, black folks, we know this. Sometimes when they are not on the same page, it turns into some way worse. So for conversation, this we can deal with.
That's it, Jonathan. All right, Jonathan.
Last but not least.
All right. I'm so charmed by tonight. There was so much beauty in the room, and I love that there were so many comments about our ability to reach across the aisle when we're not on the same page. And I feel like there are a lot of community organizers in this room, and not all community organizers work at not-for-profits. Some people just learn how to get people linked together. And I think it would be really nice as we continue this conversation about being black in Seattle for people to start feeling that they have the different communities they want to be part of. So we've heard a lot of people say that they're transplants. We've heard people who are born and raised here speak up. But the reality is that in order for you to feel at home in a place, you need a community to settle in. And if you're like a lot of people, you need different communities. So I like bohemian black community. I like multiracial communities. I like people who are into social justice. I like my bougie friends. I can't always hang out with them and get down with them, but I think that they need to have a place where they can make sense of the world. When I come to an event and I see a sister with a lace front, I love it. I've had my dreads for almost 20 years, but that's plurality. And I also wanted to just, in that spirit of connecting people, say there is a conversation that's been happening monthly called the Seattle People of Color Salon. It's not an all-black group. It's a all people of color group, but we got together because we realize that when people are projecting and saying, oh, we're moving to a majority people of color, I refuse to say majority minority because it's stupid, but a majority of people of color country, that communities of color need to speak to one another, because just having white supremacy as our lens won't help us deal with the way we treat one another. And so just having that moment to do that together. And I want to thank KUOW, but I also think it would be really awesome if we had a list of groups that we wanted to support. And it could be from the Seattle Art Museum to Langston to Blackstack on down the line, so we know where we want our dollars to go. Because we need this to happen, and the frustration in the room happens when you think you can only have the conversation once. Yeah. Keep having the conversation and insist on community. Thank you.
Thank you. I think she summed it. I think she summed it up very well. And I'm gonna. Yeah. I just. Yeah.
All I want to say is thank you. This has been a long time coming for me to see my brothers and sisters of all different hues agreeing to disagree. I was born and raised in Seattle, Washington. I'm very proud of that. I've not always lived in Seattle, Washington, only because I'm a product of being an Army brat. My father was one of the first African males to be on the radio for Como Radio. He also worked with Bob Summerize. He trained most of the African-American disc jockeys and commentators here in Seattle, Washington, and Tacoma, and Puyallup, and Spokane, and the U.S. Armed Forces. My father's name was William Tunstall, Little Bill. He also was a very good friend. I grew up with people like Eartha Kitt, Billie Holiday, Ray Charles, Little Willie John, coming to the Yesler Terrace to go to sleep because there was no place for them to go get a hotel room. We've talked about everything in this room. And I'm sorry, I have to disagree. This is the honey pot of education, of theater, of the actors, writers, they all came here. If they weren't already born here. And I'm older than dust, but I'm going to keep on fussing. And I'm going to keep on educating people. I did not have the privilege to have my own children, but I went to the PTA meetings.
There you go. Amen.
I went to the Urban League to fight for the little people. Mm-hmm. And we need to keep fighting for little people. I lived in Mercer Island for 14 years, and I felt like I was in a fishbowl. Mm-hmm. It's okay to be proud and be from Washington, but baby, when you try to go get to close to the water, they look at you real crazy. I have a right to be here. You all have a right to be here. Green, white, polka dot, purple, and black. We all have a right.
Well, thank you, everyone. Any last words from the panel?
Yeah, I just want to say for the young people who are here who feel like they're being excluded, I hope at the next forum you bring more people out, because if you're waiting for an invitation from us old people, it's probably not going to come. So now that you've been here and you know that this is happening, go out and bring more of your friends here. There was a man that used to go to the Seattle School District board meetings, and he would always complain that he was the only brown person there. And one day I finally asked him, how come you're not bringing people with you then? If you know, tell everybody. That's the whole point of a network. If you know, tell somebody else and bring them. So hopefully we'll see you, we'll be in the audience, and we will see more young people here next time, because I know you're going to do this again, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Next time we'll see more young people represented, but I'm encouraging you to actually bring people out and not wait for a special invitation.
Thank you. Thank you.
I just want to say you all have these little sheets of paper that had just a couple of topics, but if you could fill them out or write a topic and then leave it at the door. And we also have all of these questions and topics that we never got to. We do plan to have more of these, and I thank you all for coming out. And we have one more thing we'd like to...
It took me a long time to find and get involved with the arts community here in Seattle, but I want to tell you that the Central District Forum for Arts and Ideas, our office is right there on the corner, 14th and Yesler. We have events year-round that focus on black culture and provoking thought and conversations like this one today. Our next event is November 23rd at Spectrum Dance Theater down the way. We're highlighting 5 talented black emerging dancers. So come out, check it out, and I swear you will love CD Forum for the rest of your life.
I know. Thank you very much, and thank you everyone for coming out.
You and I need to hang out.
There we go.